I'm going in a minute to invite Stephen Richards to introduce the paper Applying Survival Models to Pensioner Mortality Data. Stephen has a slightly flexible introduction depending on how many people want to speak. So can I at this stage ask how many people have in mind that they might wish to make a contribution to the discussion? One. Well, I think in that case, Stephen, you can use the longer version of your introduction.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you for turning up this evening. I hope you find this worthwhile. I'm going to go through basically a summary of the paper with one or two extra details which aren't actually in the paper this evening. I'm going to talk about the need for statistical modelling in modern actuarial work, about the data preparation steps which are often overlooked but extremely important for model building. And I'm going to talk about some of the meat of the paper, specifically so-called geodemographic models for mortality. Then talk a little about the criteria for picking a particular model, finishing up with the difference between a statistical model and a model suitable for application in financial services, and then there'll be plenty of opportunity for feedback from the audience. Need for modelling is perhaps best summed up with this table, which comes from a 2004 paper from myself and Gavin Jones back in 2004, obviously. And what it does is it actually shows the financial impact of different rating factors, gender, lifestyle, driven by postcode, time since retirement, size of pension, and UK region. And it shows a step-by-step change, changing one rating factor at a time, where the base case is a female, high income, high status in the southeast of England, making one change to male, changes the annuity factor by over 9%, changing again from high status to low socioeconomic status, changes the annuity reserve by nearly 10%. And what we can see here is that each one of these rating factor changes is highly material in a financial sense. These are for annuity factors age 65, and given that pricing margin for an annuity is perhaps around 5%, every single one of these rating factors is very significant for pricing or profitability, and you can see here that getting one of these wrong would make a very substantial dent in your profitability. So modelling is extremely important because pricing margins are relatively thin in comparison to the financial impact of some of these rating factors. My chosen method of modelling, the subject of the paper, is to use what's called survival models. These are different from some other models that have been used to date. They model mortality at the level of the individual, not the group. And they model people throughout the whole time they're observed in the portfolio. So they're not observed for a particular calendar year or for a particular policy year. They're observed from the moment they enter observation, the moment, in this particular instance, the moment your pension starts being paid, to the moment they cease being observed, either because you've taken an extract of the data and they're still alive or because they've died. This particular slide shows a classic survival model example. The lower case shows a life entering age X, dying at age X plus T, and a little indicator variable D telling us that they've actually in fact died at that particular point in time. The upper example shows someone who was still alive at the time the extract was taken. They have also entered age X. They have also exited at age X plus T. But the indicator variable, D equals zero, tells us that they were alive at the point the extract was taken. Whoops. Now, in statistical terms, this time that someone's been observed is called the waiting time. In actuarial work, you remember it from your previous exams as the central exposed to risk. It's the time lived, basically. D is this event indicator in survival modelling terms. It basically tells you whether or not the person was alive or dead at the time they stopped being observed. T and D, the time observed and the death indicator, are not independent, so they're actually considered as a pair, an information pair. They're not actually considered separately. Not all of the lives will have died at the time that you take the extract from your database. So these survival times are what's known as right-censored. There'll be a population of people at the time you take the extract. Some are dead, the others are alive. All you can say about the ones who are alive is that they will die at some point in the future at an unknown time. That's called right-censoring because in the previous slide here, you can see in the top line that someone's actually died to the right of the date of extract. The difference between the modeling here and classical survival models is that survival models in wider application usually assume that you're modeling from the very start of an individual's lifetime. In life insurance and pension work, obviously, children at birth do not take out life insurance contracts. They usually take out contracts much later on in life. And this leads to a problem with what's called left truncation. People do not enter observation at age zero. They enter at age 60 or 65 when they retire. This is quite problematic mathematically, but this is actually called left truncation because people don't enter at age zero. They enter at some point after birth. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about data preparation, which is a bit of a Cinderella subject. There are four stages. The first is extracting your information from a payment system, for example, or an administration system. The second is validating that information to make sure that it makes sense. The next step is deduplication, which is dealing with the fact that wealthier individuals have a tendency to have more than one policy. And the final stage is profiling, which is our last stage to applying these geodemographic models, these models based on postcode. We prefer the data to be extracted directly from the payment system or the administration system rather than dealing with valuation extracts that actuaries prepare for doing their year-end valuation. This is because we prefer the actual underlying data because it's much easier to sense check. It's usually easier to get the information that you need, like postcode, exact date of birth, and so on. We particularly prefer to extract dates, as in dates of birth, dates of pension commencement, rather than some pre-calculated statistic like the age or the age of retirement. With the validation stage, it's very simple sense checks, where I'm just making sure that, for example, the gender field does have an M or an F and isn't blank or X or something. We also check for basic consistency. For example, the pension start date is after the date of birth and doesn't lie before the date of birth, some nonsense like that. It's all part of the validation stage. And we pay particular attention to sense checks where the data is technically valid but indicates some suspicious feature. For example, 1101 is a perfectly valid date of birth to have, but if you have 3,500 people in an annuity portfolio with that date of birth, it's more likely to be a dummy date of birth that's been assigned to people during some kind of systems migration. So we check not only the basic validity and that it's actually internally consistent, but we also actually look at some frequency counts of the data after checking the validation to make sure that it is in fact dates of birth that are in there rather than some dummy dates of birth. One particular issue with life office data, and also applies to pension fund data, is that it's benefits orientated. The life insurance data is very much orientated around the policy because that's your legal liability. With the pension scheme, it's often orientated around a particular benefit segment. The problem with this is actually very common in life portfolios for one person to have multiple policies. I've seen one particular portfolio where there's a chap with 32 separate annuity policies. I've seen a number of pension schemes where people have actually joined the scheme, left, come back to the employer, and they have more than one benefit record as a result. Or husband and wife couples, they've both got benefit records in their own right. One of them dies, and the other gets a spouse's benefit, and then they have two records in the scheme. Now, this particular tendency in life insurance companies is often strongly correlated with wealth. The wealthier someone is, the more likely they are to have multiple policies with the same insurer. Now, it's essential to do what we call deduplicate this data, because when you're building statistical models, you need independence between the events you're trying to model. This is obviously not the case if one chap has 32 policies. If he dies for one, he dies for the other 31 policies. So it's extremely important when building statistical models to carry out deduplication and look through the benefit-orientated records and create a data set of the actual people behind these benefit records. Now, one problem is, how do you go about recognizing duplicate records? The system's own client ID is usually not reliable. Things like national insurance number are more often honored in the breach, as in entering false national insurance numbers or just not entering them at all. But what we find is the most effective and reliable is to actually create a deduplication key from the basic underlying data. What we do is we create this key from data that we can be fairly sure is reliable. We don't know, or we have no real means of checking for a particular national insurance number is the accurate national insurance number, but we can be reasonably certain that, for example, the date of birth, the gender, the surname, the forename, and the postcode are probably more likely to be reliably entered. And we can combine these five pieces of information to create a deduplication key. And if they all match, then it's likely to be the same person behind two benefit records. Here's an example. Forename fields, for example, there's a wide variety of ways that this information can be entered. Sometimes it's just your initial, sometimes it's your forename, sometimes it's spelt wrongly, sometimes you've got titles put in the forename field. So what we do is, in this particular exercise, we've just picked the first letter of a person's forenames for deduplication rather than using the full forename. As for surnames, these are often misspelled. A lot of customer service is done over the phone. It's very easy, for example, for people to enter one of the spellings of Richie. Mohammed has 12 different spellings that I know of. The DeSantis examples were taken from one client's portfolio, where Mrs. DeSantis had three policies, and in each one, she was given a separate client record where her surname was typed in a different way. We've used here something which we call double metaphone, which is a way of dealing with misspellings that we can actually look through a surname and actually match it according to common misspellings. So this particular example shows how the double metaphone approach will actually deal with misspelled surnames. So we use this process, we've validated our data, we've managed to do the deduplication, we've countered misspellings of surnames. And we go on to what's called profiling. We use what's called geodemographic models. And what this basically involves is taking someone's postcode and using it as a proxy for their socioeconomic group. It's long established that socioeconomic groups are a very powerful rating factor for mortality. This chart's from ONS data, which shows the very persistent and indeed widening socioeconomic differentials amongst males aged 65 in England and Wales. And what we're actually looking for is a way of looking at or tagging people for their socioeconomic group. Problem is, the ONS data uses occupation to determine socioeconomic group, and that's very seldom recorded in payment systems. The traditional actuarial approach is to weight calculations by pension size, but that's an increasingly unreliable way of getting at someone's socioeconomic group. An example here from the world of the DC pension, a stakeholder fund of £8,500, which, if that was all the person had, that would probably be a poorer person from a lower socioeconomic group. This individual happens to have an AVC fund in a completely separate company of nearly £43,000. And when you add that together and take into account the fact that if you've got an AVC, you've got main scheme benefits elsewhere, this person is not in fact that poor and is probably of a fairly high socioeconomic group and much longer lived than the £8,500 fund would lead you to believe. So this person's not as poor as the £8,500 fund size would lead you to believe. And the problem is, looking at a policy in isolation only gives you one part of someone's total wealth makeup. Now, what we use here in this example is a person's address or postcode to derive their geodemographic profile. Now, this is more reliable because in the previous example, it was actually my stakeholder fund, my ABC, my address is the same in each case. So even although each individual insurer doesn't know my total wealth, all my other pension pots, my address and my postcode are the same in each administration system. So if you're using postcode or address to profile me for my socioeconomic group, you're more likely to get it right than if you use my pension size or the size of my pension fund. Now, point of clarification, postcode we need here is the full two-part UK postcode. We've got a number of options. We could use, for example, Mosaic from Experian. We could use Fizz, also from Experian. We could use something called Acorn. There are a variety of different geodemographic profilers that will take a UK postcode and map it onto a socioeconomic profile. There's an example here, which is my postcode. In the Mosaic classification, I'm Mosaic type 02. Under the Acorn classification, I'm Acorn type 13. But every residential postcode in the UK will have one of these type profiles associated with it. Now, one of the things that we do after profiling, we take all our annuitants, we can put them through the profiler, we take their postcode, and we can profile them with their Experian Mosaic type. One of the last things we do before we build models is we look at this Cramer's V statistic, which measures the strength of association between two variables. The stronger the association, the stronger the two variables are linked, ranging from zero, absolutely no correlation between the two variables at all, to 100, meaning that the variables are perfectly linked and, in fact, one of them has complete information and you could basically discard the other. And what we're looking for is reasonable associations. We can see here status, which is the variable D, whether or not someone's died. The strongest association here is with year of birth. So the earlier you get a birth, the older you are, the more likely you are to be dead. That makes perfect sense here. And we can see some of the correlations between some of the other variables. For example, correlations between pension size and status suggest to us that value of 17.4. It's much bigger than zero. So that tells us that some of these variables are going to be useful for explaining mortality variation. Birth year, gender, and region code, and pension size, these are all telling us that these are possible candidates for explaining mortality variation. So we can go almost to fitting a model. Now, when we're selecting a model, we'll just look at this. We've got, this is the crude force of mortality for this life insurance portfolio. Each dot is the crude force of mortality at that age. And we can see between ages 60 and 95, there's a broadly linear association between the age and the log of the force of mortality. Below age 60, the relationship is complicated. Above age 95, it looks as though we have some data quality issues, so we'd probably restrict our modelling from ages 60 to 95, because it looks like there's nice, regular, well-behaved behaviour there. We'd have a choice of a number of actuarial mortality laws to fit. Although this is a statistical model, all of these, basically British actuaries, Gompertz, Macomb, Perks, Beards, these are all models selected, proposed by British actuaries over the last 200 odd years. And although these are statistical models, they fit in very neatly within this particular statistical modelling framework. Of particular interest is the bottom three models, or the Beard model and the Macomb Beard model, which incorporate this rho parameter, which we call the Beard parameter. And we're actually going to use this as a marker as to whether or not a model is finished. As long as the parameter rho is not zero, it tells us that there's more variation to be found in the data set beyond what our model has. Now, our model structure is we're going to pick some group as the baseline. We're going to measure mortality deviations against this baseline. So, for example, we might pick females to be the baseline, and we would measure the effect of being male. We could pick, for example, smokers to be the non-baseline, pick non-smokers to be the baseline, and we then measure the effect of being a smoker. So whenever we fit a categorical variable, we need to fit one less number of parameters than there are levels. So if there's two genders, we need one parameter to measure the effect of being male. If there were seven socioeconomic groups, we would need six parameters to fit the socioeconomic group. So we build up this model by picking a baseline and measuring deviations from it. That's just an example here where the baseline would be female non-smokers, and we would measure the effect of being male as a departure from this, and the effect of being a smoker as a departure from that as well. The interesting thing about this model is that because we're modelling mortality at the level of the individual, there's no minimum number of lives of the particular risk combination required, or if you like, the minimum is zero. This is starkly contrasts with the grouped approach, where you create a contingency table and you want to create a group of males age 65 of a particular risk classification, model the number of deaths in the group. That's a very inefficient way of using your data. The advantage of this approach is that there's no limit to the number of risk factors that you can incorporate in the model. And what we're going to do to choose between models is use something called the AIC, which is just a balancing act between how good the log likelihood is, how good the model fits, with how many parameters you used to get there. It's a kind of cost-benefit analysis. You can always make a model fit a bit better by throwing in some extra parameters. The AIC tells you whether or not those parameters were actually worthwhile, whether or not they're earning their keep. And we're going to use the mosaic type to simplify complicated variables like mosaic type. There's actually 61 mosaic types. There's 57 acorn types. And if we were to try and just fit mosaic type in a model, it would demand 60 parameters. Now that makes a very complicated model. That's not particularly convenient to use. So what we actually want to do, for example, is derive, say, three broad social class classifications using mosaic type, but we want three groups, not 61. And what we do is we use the AIC to test different assignments of the 61 mosaic types to the three groups and work out the optimum. We use the AIC to determine what the optimum is. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to skip over the frailty models and just actually look at a deliberately oversimplified model. This just includes age, so it ignores gender and all sorts of other rating factors. What's important is not the absolute value of this AIC, but the difference in the AIC. So we can see here, the Gompertz law will treat as our kind of standard, and all of the other models provide a materially better fit, looking down this column with the negative numbers. The interesting point is that adding a parameter will not always improve the fit. We add one parameter with the Macomb model, but in fact, the parameter is not really worth it. The AIC goes up rather than down. The bottom four models all show very significant improvements over the basic Gompertz model. But what we're using is this Beard parameter as a measure of variation that we haven't yet explained. And the fact that there's such a large difference between the Beard model and the Gompertz model is telling us that there's important rating factors affecting mortality that the model does not actually include. Now, we know that the obvious one here is gender, but this is just to actually show the impact and the usefulness of this Beard factor for detecting unexplained variation. We can move to a more realistic model and add gender. So we've got mortality varying by age and gender. We can see here that the AIC statistics have dropped by a very large... The AICs have gone down by a very large amount from one model to the next. A statistically significant difference in AIC might be two or three. These two models actually go down by over 1,000, so that's a highly material improvement just by adding gender. What's also interesting is that the difference between the Beard and the Gompertz models is much, much smaller. Adding gender has explained a very, very large component of the variation in mortality that was in this data set. But there's still a significant difference between the Beard model and the Gompertz model, so we know that there's an awful lot more variation yet to be explained, and we know that socioeconomic group is one of these variables. What we do is do what an actuary would normally do, would be to fit pension size as a rating factor, and as expected, the models fit an awful lot better. The AIC has gone down by a very large amount, I think it's at 1,200 on average. The difference between the various models has reduced, as we can see here, but it's still very significant. So this is telling us that there's more variation left, more variation, more mortality, than is explained just by age, gender, and pension size. What we can do is we can test postcode-driven lifestyle categories, That actually fits pretty much as well as the pension size, sometimes a bit better, sometimes not as well. But what it has done is actually reduced the variation, the unexplained variation in the model, by a lot more than the pension size has. The gap between the Beard model and the Gompertz model is reduced even further. But it's not zero. This is telling us that there's still variation that's not explained by age, gender, and postcode-driven lifestyle. What we find is that a combination of postcode-driven lifestyle and pension size does much, much better than either postcode or pension size on its own. The combination of the two is better than either one of them on their own. Not just that, the combination of the two is actually better than you'd be led to believe just by looking at each one on its own. There's a phenomenon called enhancement, where the more rating factors you add to a model, the more significant rating factors you add, the better the existing ones get at explaining the variation. So adding lifestyle and pension size to the model does, if you like, it's a virtuous circle. It does a much better job than adding, and you'd be led to believe, than the two operating in isolation. What we can see here from this particular model is that although this is far and away the best fitting model so far, the fact that the difference between the Beard model and the Gompertz model is still not zero. There's still significant variation yet to be found. For example, there's duration effects, selection effects, cohort effects, but we're not going to go through those tonight. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is a very important difference between a statistical model and a model suitable for financial applications. Statistical models are basically lives-based, by definition, whereas financial liabilities are anything but lives-based. Here's an example as a very large life office portfolio of annuities and a very large portfolio of DB pensions. And what we can see here is a very common theme, regardless of whether or not it's defined benefit pensions or annuities, a tendency for the top 10% of pensioners to have round about half of all the pensions in payment. It's a tremendous concentration of liabilities. The problem for a lives-based model is that Group 1 has 10% representation in a lives-based model, but they carry five times the representation in terms of financial impact on your portfolio. In other words, statistically, they have exactly the same weighting as the bottom decile. They've also got a 10% weighting in the statistical model, but they actually have a tiny, negligible impact on your financial application. So you need to be very careful about using a lives-based model for financial applications because of this tremendous concentration of risks in a fairly small subpopulation. Now, one way that we actually can test this is we actually use bootstrapping. What we do is we will randomly sample from our data where we actually know who's died and who's not. We use the model to profile and predict the probability of these people dying. Then we check to see whether or not they did die. So we use the model to predict for data where we actually know the answer. And we compare what the model predicts with what actually happened. We can repeat this lots and lots of times so we can actually look at the variation. What we'll actually do here is put up this slide. This is not in the paper. This is a term assurance portfolio. And what it's actually looking at is the lives-based approach, which is a kind of democratic headcount, and an amounts-weighted approach, which is weighted by some assured. And we can see here that this model does a broadly decent job, where the actual ratio of actual deaths to expected deaths predicted by the model is round about one, certainly for the lives-based approach, slightly biased, slightly off-centered for one, for the amounts-weighted approach. But what's of particular interest is this very long, fat tail towards the right. So although the model is perhaps almost good enough for financial applications, there is this fat tail where the actual mortality is actually slightly heavier than is actually predicted by the model. That may require you to actually make some adjustments to the model before you actually use it in financial applications. The examples in the paper actually show cases where the lives-based and the amounts-based A over E stats for pensioners are often quite widely different. So a lot of these lives-based models, when you take them out of your statistician's hands, you need to be very careful before you actually apply them directly to financial applications. term assurance portfolios, you can use that almost without making modification. Annuities and pensions related liabilities tend to be much more concentrated than other classes of business, and these models almost always need further modification before applying to financial applications. So, quick summary. Insured data happens to be a very natural fit to survival models. You know the exact date a benefit started being paid, and you know the exact date it stopped. Careful data preparation is extremely important for this, to ensure the independence assumption between the observations and to ensure that the data is of decent quality. We found that geodemographic models, models based on address or postcode, provide substantial improvements to models for mortality and other risks over and above what you might expect from just using benefit size. A combination of benefit size and postcode usually provides a much better fit than just using pension size or postcode on their own. We find that the so-called beard parameter particularly useful as an indicator of how much more you've got to go in terms of adding risk factors to a particular model. And last, not least, we find that bootstrapping is essential before using a statistical model for financial purposes. It's a very important way of checking that your model is suitable for whatever financial purpose you're putting it to. Last of all, some acknowledgements. Colleague Gavin Ritchie, who helped me basically by building the algorithms for doing the deduplication. It's all done in a database. I didn't program that. And thanks to Justin Armsworth of Experian for allowing us to use the mosaic type profiles for this pensioner and annuity data set. Thank you.
I'll now ask Mike Kipling to open the discussion.
The evaluation of mortality risk in all its forms has always been a fundamental part of the profession of actuary. But to those of us who worked through the last three or four decades of the last century, it seemed to be a risk which was under control. Our attention was turned more to newer and more exciting problems: the rise and fall of inflation and interest rates, the apparently endless rise and then eventual fall of the equity market, the need for ever greater transparency and fairness for consumers of financial services. We developed new techniques for dealing with these risks, most prominently stochastic modelling and the use of ever more targeted and complex hedging vehicles. We generally think that we have the behaviour of these newer risks understood and controlled to the extent of our risk appetites. We may well even quietly be congratulating ourselves, which is mainly the banks that have taken a bath in the ongoing credit crunch and not the life insurers or pension funds. A remark, President, which I hope I will not already be regressing by the time this comes to print in the journal. So why, despite all these far more interesting possibilities, we're here tonight discussing pensioner longevity? Moreover, why are we at the end of a run of no less than five consecutive sessional meetings in England and Scotland on this very topic? Because, my dear colleagues and most welcome guests, mortality has suddenly become interesting again. Masked by high inflation and high investment returns, and by the relative youth of pension schemes and life insurance annuity portfolios, the initial acceleration in the rate of improvement of longevity did not feature usually among the most important risks to control and understand, but with that masking now stripped away and with the maturing of the owning vehicles, longevity has recently leapt up the list of priorities for risk managers. We cannot rely on the comfortable techniques of the last century to address this re-emergent risk, however. If market solutions are to be found to transfer the risks from their current unwilling and overexposed owners to those with an appetite and with the capital to take them on for reward, then modern techniques on which sophisticated investors are prepared to rely are needed. We need 21st century solutions tackle this 21st century problem. And thanks to Stephen Richards and to others like him within and alongside the profession, we now have the opportunity to see these techniques emerge. There are many things necessary to get right when pricing annuity risk. As the pension regulator's recent consultation document emphasises, two crucial demographic elements are a best estimate of the current rate of mortality and a best estimate of the speeds and directions in which these will change in future. An essential accompaniment for most actuarial applications is the estimated distribution of actual future longevity outcomes around these best estimates. Tonight's paper focuses very much on the first of these elements, the current level of mortality, and in particular on how this differs according to a number of measurable proxy factors for direct causal influences. The other sessional meetings this year have also largely been about this element, although 2007, of course, saw the publication of the CMI's Library of Mortality Projections, and TPR have also recently pronounced on this subject as well. An important aspect of tonight's paper is its use of survival models. This is a technique which Angus MacDonald drew to our attention in 1996, although having first been applied to mortality by Cox as long ago as 1972. Stephen Richards and colleagues more recently presented specific applications of survival models applied to TEA survival probabilities in their paper Two-Dimensional Mortality Data, Patterns and Projections, presented to the faculty in 2007. This demonstrated in particular the ability of this method to separate out time trends in longevity improvements from cohort trends. Tantalizing glimpses were also given of the possibility of introducing other parameters into the model besides age, birth cohort, and time. Tonight's paper has revealed more. The paper can, in some ways, be divided into two parts. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 8 provide an illuminating and occasionally amusing canter through the trials and tribulations of cleaning up a life office or pension scheme database to provide reliable data on which to work. Anyone embarking upon analysing their own databases would be well advised to use this paper as a checklist. Sorting data into numerical order and looking at the extreme values is one I highly recommend. Recently doing this on a portfolio of deferred annuities revealed that the highest planned retirement age is 285. Almost certainly an error, but I did just check first that the policyholder's name wasn't Aubrey de Grey. The paper then proceeds to explain the methodology that has been adopted, carefully relating it to the laws of mortality with which we are all familiar. The meat of the paper begins in section 7, where the concept of the Gomperz alpha and beta parameters is extended to individual lives and sub-parameterized in relation to the risk factors pertinent to each life, gender, birth cohort, postcode, etc. A method of avoiding over-parameterization is also introduced with the Akaiki information criteria, enabling this to be done objectively. Table 6 on page 18 presents the first set of results, comparing the ability of the different models to most efficiently fit the data. It can be clearly seen from figure 4 that models which allow for late life deceleration, or to use non-technical parlance, which droop a bit at the top, fit better. Gender, not surprisingly, results in a significant improvement in fit, AIC reduction of 1800 to 1900, and pension size a further improvement, as Stephen has just shown us on the screen. Even just using three optimally computed bands. The size bands determined here are divided in the low mid high ratio of 28, 54, 18. Last month, the Institute discussed the first ever CMI graduation of occupational pension scheme data. It is interesting to note that the proposed CMI light amounts table is to be based on approximately the top 25% of their exposure, not too far away from Stephen and Richard's 18%. The CMI light table produces an expectation of life at 65 of 18.8 years, compared with only 16.8 years on the alternative heavy tables, which are based on the balance of the 75% of the CMI exposure. This is a 15% longer expectation of life for the lighter group, even with this very broad differentiation. And put alternatively, the valuation difference in a 5% annuity at age 65 is nearly 11%. Tonight's paper continues by examining a lifestyle factor derived from postcodes and mosaic type. This is a more efficient fit for the data than size, and also seems to account for more of the differences between the different mortality laws. An even better fit is achieved when both factors are used together, suggesting that they are by no means complete proxies for each other. The author then finds in Table 11 a significantly wider differential in life expectation and annuity values between the highest and lowest male categories than between the CMI light and heavy tables, some 30% on expectancy and 21% on value. These material differences clearly show the importance of correctly categorising members of a pension fund or the incoming annuitants of an insurance company. Indeed, more granularity may be necessary if it is considered likely that the lives concerned fall at the extreme ends of the size or any other categorisation. There might also be a message for the CMI in tonight's paper, which would it be better to issue three tables, light, medium and heavy, covering, say, the top 20%, the middle 50% and the bottom 30% of the mortality spectrum, respectively. In section 10, the author turns to patterns observable from the residuals. Figure 5 reveals clearly observable initial selection and time dependencies, and possibly some more subtle age cohort effects. Attempting to strip these out by adding more parameters to the survival model is partially successful, although the patterns in Figure 6 suggest that some further work could achieve more. The less observant reader should note that the scale change on the time graph makes the benefit of adding this parameter appear less than it really is. The clear evidence of initial selection may be something the CMI would want to consider for future graduations, especially as it appears to be driven in part by an increasing prevalence of underwriting. Finally, in section 11, the author very helpfully suggests a practical approach to test whether there are concentrations of risk factors in a particular portfolio which might not be picked up by a model fitted to a wider experience, particularly if relatively few factors have been built into the model. The case of industry-specific mortality is given as a classic example. We have been given plenty to digest, and I will not take up much more valuable discussion time. Areas where the discussion might usefully focus, though, may include: what are the most useful factors to fit models to? Is there much data about past occupation, for example? Perhaps the bulk buyout experts can enlighten us. At a scheme level, what account needs to be taken of the different risk factors for management relative to that of blue-collar staff, given the former's typically high benefit levels? Are there problems caused by people changing address around the time of retirement? Is the effect of 40 years living in Glasgow eliminated by a move to Torquay? And can we allow for this in any way? How can we allow for the increasing number of people who retire abroad? What is the mosaic type for Marbella? How good are the links between proxy factors such as amounts and address and causal factors such as health and past occupation? Over time, will enough data on the health of those taking out underwritten annuities become available to be useful as survival factors? Perhaps most importantly of all, how can we link this work in with that on the other crucial mortality unknown, future improvement rates? Can, for example, survival models cast any light whether mortality differentials between social categories will continue to widen or begin to narrow? Or can they add to the accuracy of piece-blind projections by giving greater insight into the future progress of time and cohort factors? There will also be those here tonight who are quite happy with using the more traditional, though not all that traditional, GLM techniques on QX, It would be useful in the discussion to hear from them and whether their findings agree with or differ from those in the paper. President, we are once again in Stephen Richards' debt for presenting this paper, which progresses our practical understanding of mortality in such a user-friendly way. In particular, however, Stephen should be applauded for the superhuman effort it must have taken to accumulate, understand, clean and analyse data from a range of life offices and pension schemes covering over 700,000 lives and nearly 120,000 deaths over a period of 8 or so years. Stephen, we congratulate you and thank you once again for your inspiring paper.
Thank you very much indeed, Mike, and you've certainly given us plenty of ideas for the discussion. I just wanted to pick you up on one point, though. We decided, I think, at the end of the last meeting that mortality was exciting, and you described it merely as interesting. So I think I like the exciting definition, description. Right, now the discussion is open to the floor. We do need a few more speakers. You don't have to make a long speech. You can even ask questions of Stephen Richards if you'd like to do that. Please don't let the fact that the meeting's being recorded deter you from contributing. You can certainly edit your remarks in the transcript, although I can't promise that we can do much about the televised version. Roving microphones are available should you wish to speak from the main body of the hall. Alternatively, you can make your way to the lectern at the front of the hall. And finally, can you please state your name clearly before making your contribution? So I'd like to ask Matthew Edwards to make the first contribution, please.
Well, thanks must go to the speaker for a most learned and thought-provoking paper. One aspect of the approach I especially like is the extra power it gives us to allow for any non-linearity of mortality within individual years of age, which will be useful indeed when analysing portfolios of centenarians or if writing annuities to people in their 90s. If we do have very old portfolios and this non-linearity is of concern, there is of course nothing to stop us from applying GLM techniques to study monthly rather than annual mortality. In the same vein, we could also feed partial years information into GLMs without any problem, not that this is a particularly material issue. I'm afraid I've already started a comparison with GLMs, generalized linear models, because they're the obvious point of comparison in considering the usefulness of survival models, and they've been used in the field of mortality analysis for quite a few years now. In any discussion of survival models, I think we should ask ourselves whether they offer anything substantial that GLMs don't. I notice a general lack of reference to GLMs in the paper, engendering a sort of Banco's ghost feeling. The author of the paper has, I think, in the past contended that GLMs cannot be used with many years of data because we would be violating an independence requirement. This is a contention disagreed with by all GLM practitioners I know. The reason why there is not such a time series dependence problem follows quickly and simply from the fact that we're modelling conditional probabilities. Indeed, if there were any such dependence problem, one could almost argue that it would invalidate all of the CMI's normal multi-year investigations. It's also been contended that linearity constraints would in some way invalidate the use of GLMs, but this perhaps results from a curious misunderstanding of what the word linear means in the GLM context. If you're interested, I did outline in last month's Action magazine what the word means, although I don't suppose many of you actually received your copy. Wasn't like that in my day. So that's a theoretical perspective on why we're quite happy with multi-year GLMs and therefore to want strong reasons to move to a different methodology. But I'm now going to say something that may sound slightly extreme, which is this. The theory behind any particular model, and here I'm using model to mean a particular set of numbers describing the experience of a particular portfolio, is irrelevant. Mortality analysis is a completely empirical field, and the only measure of success is what works. And by works, I mean being demonstrably predictive, where we test predictiveness on another independent portion of the data. We work in a completely empirical field in this regard, And in that vein, we could show empirically that multi-year GLM analyses give us far more predictive models than single-year analyses do when tested against independent portions of the data. So whether looking at the question from a theoretical or the more important empirical perspective, there is clearly no problem with using GLMs on many years' data. It therefore becomes more interesting to ask what survival models can offer that GLMs cannot. I'll return to the empirical perspective later because it's fundamental to any discussion of mortality, but I'd first like to consider the parametric formulation of the survival model and the highly debatable contention in the paper that a major advantage of fitting a statistical model is that smoothness is built in. Is this a good thing or a bad thing? If you'll permit, I'd like to address this in a slightly different way to make the point more tangible. In a recent article on survival models, the author reformulated the concept by saying that survival models offered advantages over GLMs because we can derive better estimates where data is sparse. Alas, the field of data analysis is something of a zero-sum game. We can't analyze what we don't have. For the sake of example, if we don't have any 83-year-olds, the only way to get an estimate of Q83, or M83 if you prefer, is by imposing a parametric relationship and inferring Q83 from what is observed at nearby ages. This means we are deliberately distorting the model by forcing it to fit our a priori parametric preconceptions. Quite a nice tongue twister. Very often in this field, preconceptions turn out to be misconceptions. The GLM has the advantage of being less parametric. It's far better to look at the crude rates produced by GLMs, which in practical terms function as non-parametric methods. And if necessary, because of data weakness, we can then fit B splines, Bessel splines. The ability to run GLMs with some variance being described by B splines is very powerful indeed and gives us the best of both worlds. We first see what the data is saying, and then, if we want to, we fit splines where data are sparse. In any case, I strongly recommend working with crude estimates when thinking about which standard tables fit the experience. The wider question of parametric as opposed to non-parametric methods is an interesting one. When I was writing some of the ACTED course material, course notes on survival models 10 years ago, and tutoring the survival model mortality subject, I thought they offered a promising non-parametric way forward, something I later discussed in an editorial in the ACTRI. And I must admit, I do find it disappointing that the approach outlined in the paper follows the parametric route, exposing us to the potentially distortive effect of the modeler's preconceptions. Of course, whether survival model results do or don't contain any parametric bias is the sort of thing that we can test with reference to an independent part of the data, which brings us back to the empirical perspective that is so extremely important. The underlying theory behind any particular model is fundamentally irrelevant, be it GLM, survival model, reading tea leaves. There is no magic best formula to describe how mortality works. The only thing that matters is how predictive our particular results are, where we test how predictive they are using an independent testing part of the data. This is especially important where working with complex multivariate models, and even more so if experimenting with a somewhat new methodology, which is the case here. This empirical aspect, the testing of predictiveness, is fundamental not only in testing in absolute terms, if you like, the validity of any one model, but also in comparing different approaches. If we should wish to say that one method is better than another, we would wish to see some sort of comparison of predictiveness. Again, the empirical aspect is what is completely fundamental here if we should wish to choose between different methods. The theoretical underpin of any particular model is of no relevance. What is important is the empirical aspect, the predictiveness, and demonstrating that predictiveness, whether we're looking at one model in isolation or wishing to compare different models. This empirical perspective is particularly important in checking that we have not overfitted the model to the data. Some of the categorization procedures outlined in the paper do seem to carry with them this very risk of overfitting, ending up with a self-prophesying model of the postcode factor in particular. Any GI pricing actuary can explain what the dangers are when grouping such factors and how to avoid the problem. We can return to this point in more detail later if that would be useful. On the subject then of segmentation and the geodemographic factor, from the advanced details about the paper, I was expecting a bit more of a discussion about the financial significance of segmentation, but the matter was not discussed in detail, but that's more of a question, obviously, of my deluded expectations. In general, what matters in a mortality analysis done for the sake of portfolio pricing is what will have a material and valid effect on the NPV, the net present value of portfolio cash flows. In that context, it's normally the case that any segmentation over and beyond segmentation by benefit amount, although it may appear interesting in abstract mortality terms, will not have a material and valid effect on the NPV. And we can come back later to this question of valid, which boils down to how much we might accurately project observed historical multiplicative relationships. But supposing that we do wish to do something intelligent with postcodes, what should we do? The socioeconomic data discussed in the paper are just proxies. In fact, proxies with a very non-transparent black box origin, with apologies for any guests from those particular firms. Obviously, proxies are proxies. They just approximate to whatever underlying reality there might be out there. If modelling mortality, we should be basing our postcode groupings on mortality, not on a proxy. These simplistic proxies may serve as a useful beginner's introduction to the subject, giving a point of comparison for proper postcode groupings, but any serious modelling in this field should focus on the mortality characteristics of the portfolio in question. A better approach is to calculate the residual mortality effect in every geographical region and from there derive mortality-based postcode groupings. The work is quite fiddly because of the need to avoid the self-prophesying model trap, but it's not difficult to come up with predictive postcode groupings that are based on the mortality experience of the portfolio in question. This is a more valid approach than basing our work on black box off-the-shelf proxies and will in general give more predictive categorizations, which of course we will test and compare against alternatives because we work in an empirical field. It's a particular concern of mine in the current bulk purchase annuity market, where we have the strange groupthink situation of a very competitive market, but many players not only using the same recipes, if you like, but recipes which seem inherently flawed because based on simplistic proxies and dangerous categorization techniques. You could regard it as either tragic or comic. I suppose the comic aspect arises because many of them think they're being very clever. But maybe that's what makes it tragic. Two minor observations now before I conclude. First, I was surprised by the treatment of year of birth in the paper, where we seem to be breaking things down into just three very broad year of birth groups. With GLMs, we normally find no problem at all with a year-by-year treatment of year of birth, and this can bring out very surprising features of annuity portfolios and pension schemes. In fact, very often, we've seen almost the complete opposite of what people generally consider to be the cohort effect. This is obviously very useful information when thinking about improvement assumptions. My second minor observation, there is a very thorough and impressive section on data handling, which will no doubt become a standard reference on this for some time to come. This is clearly a vital part of any mortality analysis, but there is a risk of going down the wrong track as regards grouping together the benefit segments held by individuals. Although intuitively, statistically, it's right to group benefit segments, if we conduct our analysis on regrouped data, but our mortality results are then applied to raw, ungrouped valuation data at the stage of the cash flow projection, there is an inconsistency which could easily make the whole process wrong. I think this is a situation that may have been happening a lot with a disconnect between the mortality analysis data preparation and how the cash flow projection teams treat the data. The paper itself is not saying anything wrong here, but it's an obvious issue that I feel many people may have neglected. So concluding, my comments have, to some extent, come from thinking about the differences between GLMs and survival models. And of course, there are quite a few differences. To my mind, GLMs are more robust and more flexible and more tested in this field, are less exposed to parametric bias, and the modeler's preconceptions are much, much, much more transparent and offer various other highly exciting applications, e.g. generating closed form solutions in ALM contexts. But the differences are dwarfed by the similarities. They are both mathematically inelegant ways to fit crude multiplicative models to the observed mortality of large amounts of data, using brute force numerical algorithms to find the optimal fit. Their similarities in this regard mean that, unhappily, they share notable defects. First, we risk assuming the constancy of recently observed multiplicative relationships over the next 30 to 40 years. This is clearly wrong. A socioeconomic mortality differential of 2, observed when a portfolio's average age was 70, will of course not be 2 in 10 years' time, if we're talking about a closed book, which we normally are for these portfolio cash flow valuation contexts. Hence my scepticism about the worth of such segmentation in the context of portfolio cash flow valuations. And of course, I'm even more sceptical if self-prophesying modelling techniques may have led to overstated, i.e. wrong, multiplicative differentials in the first place. Secondly, the methods encourage over-segmentation, which will often be spurious from a financial perspective and lead to extra operational risk where the results are used. Thirdly, and most importantly, we still don't have a clue about mortality improvements, although we may get strong hints from the year of birth or calendar year of exposure trends indicated by the models. Any difference between GLM and survival model results will be absolutely swamped by this future variability. You might therefore think it's splitting hairs to have two actuaries arguing about the relative merits of two conceptually somewhat similar mortality modelling approaches. First, because we work in an empirical field and the theory underlying any particular model is irrelevant compared with the empirical question of validated predictiveness. Secondly, because any differences will be completely swamped by the uncertainties of what the future brings. I suggest that if we are to devote time and effort to dreaming up new mortality modelling techniques, given that survival models do not seem to offer any substantial advantages over GLMs, and indeed offer some disadvantages, and I don't see much purpose in reinventing the wheel or in replacing the wheel with something which may in fact be inferior, a more fruitful line of research would be to come up with analytic techniques which tie in better with recent thinking about future mortality trends. Since the most promising thinking on improvements seems to be coming from the area of disease-based modelling, it would be useful to start thinking about analyses that can model experience in a similar way, and I'm very interested in whether GAMs, generalised additive models, may offer us a useful way forward here in modelling the different building blocks of mortality and then adding those blocks together. And those are my thoughts on the matter at hand.
Thank you very much, Matthew.
Right, now it's time for some other contributions. We have a hand over there, yes. Oh, Louise Pryor, yes.
My name is Louise Pryor. The earth now refers to the middle sections as the meat of the paper, possibly thinking of it as a sandwich. This impression was reinforced when you said it again that there was plenty to digest in it. I'd like to continue that metaphor by saying that it's the bread that provides a sandwich with its structural integrity. And I think that the outer sections of the paper were extremely valuable. I've always liked Yogi Berra's characterization of the issue. In theory, theory and practice are the same. In practice, they're different. However good your model, if it's based on poor data, or if you're not trying to model the right thing, you've got problems. And this paper provides valuable examples of data problems and of how the blind application of a model can be unwise. And of course, it's not only in mortality modelling that these problems arise. I think this paper brings out some useful points that are much more widely applicable. To get back to the meat, it's extremely useful to have such a clear explanation of a method of geodemographic mortality modelling. We've been hearing about this for a long time, but with the exception probably of the specialists in the field, there's been no readily accessible explanation of how it actually works in practice. And I really welcome that. I think it will be very useful to a lot of people. And I have to say that even the meatier sections of the paper provide a lot of useful and interesting information about the practicalities of model fitting and sort of how to go on and when to stop. In summary, I'd like to thank the author for such a valuable contribution, especially on the practical modelling aspects. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Right, who would like to make the next contribution? It's Andrew Smith.
Good evening, Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen. I welcome this paper. I'd like to thank the author for its preparation. I've got a few observations. Firstly, to comment on the point that the author has already made about the difference between statistical significance and financial significance. He mentioned how you might potentially weight observations by amounts to give something like a by amounts analysis. And that puzzled me a little bit, because I think that if amounts is in the explanatory variables, if you just think of doing a regression analysis of y against x, if x is in your explanatory variables, then you're going to hit not only the mean value of y in the forecast, but also the mean value of x times y. So I didn't quite see why the weighting was necessary, or why they might not align in the first place. That may have been my weakness in understanding what was written, but I'd welcome some clarity on that. Of course, there is one way where we could gauge the financial significance a lot more easily, and that would be if the author had chosen to disclose the fitted parameters, as is customarily the case when describing the goodness of fitted models. Instead, what we have is the Keike information criterion, which is interesting but doesn't really tell us about whether parameters are financially significant. So, for example, you may have a demographic effect which only changes the mortality by 0.5% of the force of mortality, but is still statistically very significant, since the number of parameters involved is of the order of 5 or 10 in each case. I assume it wasn't reasons of space that prevented their publication, and I would have welcomed that. Another thing which puzzled me is the interpretation of this magic beard parameter rho, which the author contends diagnoses heterogeneity within a population. And I tried to figure this out. I was slightly hampered by the fact that Appendix 1 seems to have a bit of a notation conflict where alpha switches into A's and then back again. Z starts off as a random variable, then Z is e to the alpha as well, and then alpha appears in the answer so for the mean, so I don't think that's quite right. But when I finally unscrambled it, I think what I worked out was that this is underlying, this is a frailty model where different individuals have their own personal multiple of the standard table. And the effect then is that if you've got a very wide range of individual frailties, then the people with the highest frailties die off and you're left with the people with the lower frailties. So instead of getting an exponentially increasing force of mortality, you get a force of mortality that levels off. But it seems to me that heterogeneity is not the only possible explanation for that effect. And so it seemed to me not entirely convincing to allocate a non-zero value of rho to indicate this heterogeneity. It might just be your initial first guess at the shape was wrong, and add an extra parameter made it a bit better. So in conclusion, I'd like to thank the author for the paper. Just a few minor observations. Thanks.
Who would like to go next?
Just to go through some of the points that have been raised, Mike Kipling raised the question about people changing address upon retirement, and it's true that people will often change their mosaic type code when they move from one address to another. What we find in practice is that people may change their mosaic type code, but they tend not to change the optimized mortality group they end up in. I took as an example where my parents live, where I used to live, where I live now, where I lived as a student actuary, and although the mosaic type code is different in each case, all of these type codes belong in the same socioeconomic class optimized by postcode. So while address changes might risk being an issue, in practice, people tend not to move their socioeconomic group. And if you're actually reducing the 61 mosaic types to a smaller group, you tend to find that while people will change address, they'll often not change group. Mike also mentioned the ability of survival models to look at time trends separately for socioeconomic group, separately for other risk factors. This can be done. I didn't do it in the paper for reasons of parsimony, but as a rule, I tend to find much stronger time trends for males than for females. These can be separately identified in survival models. And if the data set is large enough, then yes, you'd be able to pick up separate time trends by lifestyle group. One last point about Mike's comment on the data prep and cleaning. I wouldn't like to take the credit for that. It was actually my colleague Gavin Ritchie who wrote the database code that did all the heavy lifting, so it really wasn't much work on my behalf at all. To turn to Matthew Edwards' points, I disagree with much of what Matthew said. I have nothing in particular against generalized linear models. Indeed, I used them extensively in my former employer. I used them extensively in my initial phase as a consultant. However, I moved on to survival models simply because they are better than generalized linear models. They dealt with a number of limitations with generalized linear models that I was tired trying to find workarounds for. And I've never found a situation in practice where a survival model is not at least as good, if not better, than a generalized linear model. I was interested to note that Matthew said that you can model mortality on a monthly basis instead of an annual basis. In fact, the limit of that is to model mortality on a daily basis, and that's a survival model. It's a model for the force of mortality, which is a continuous time model. So basically, if you actually take a generalized linear model and progressively shorten the time period that you're modeling Qx, you're basically modeling mu x, which is a survival model. So if you are modeling generalized linear models on a monthly basis, it's as good as a survival model, almost. I would take issue with the point about smoothness not being desirable. I would actually say that if we go back to our basic graduation training, I'd say that smoothness is actually highly desirable, and that's a very useful feature of a parametric model in that smoothness is in fact automatic. Intuitively, it seems to make sense that mortality will increase broadly smoothly with increasing age, and a model which imposes that as a constraint doesn't seem to me to be much of an imposition at all. In fact, I find it highly useful. It automatically gives smoothness in the fitted rates without any separate smoothing step necessary. And indeed, where data is perhaps sparse, it enables a structure for mortality to be imposed, a very reasonable structure, and enables the mortality to be fitted for regions of data where it might be sparse by borrowing information from adjacent ages. With regard to the comments on postcodes, in practice, I've analyzed perhaps in excess of 15 separate life assurance portfolios and pension scheme portfolios. In all cases, I found the full postcode, the mosaic type, to be a highly useful explanatory variable for mortality differences. I have looked at regional models of mortality just using the first one or two characters of the postcode, and whatever significance I have actually seen in that rating factor in the past usually disappears when a postcode-driven lifestyle element is actually added to the model. The life portfolio, which lays behind the examples in this particular paper, shows no regional variations in mortality in the presence of a postcode-driven lifestyle group. The reason for this is quite simple. Most of what we think of as regional differentials in this country are largely differences in socioeconomic group in different regions. The reason why the northeast, northwest of England, and Glasgow have higher mortality than the southeast of England is because there are more people of higher mortality socioeconomic groups in those parts of the country. So what we think of as regional variations are predominantly socioeconomic variations. When you add socioeconomic group via lifestyle group, via postcode-driven mosaic type here, most of these regional variations will vanish. To address Andrew Smith's points, the use of the weighting is largely applicable where there's an extreme concentration of benefits. In most portfolio cases, you don't need to have benefit size as a rating factor and to weight the parameters. The example I put up in the presentation for term assurances, for example, showed that the unweighted model did an almost ideal job. For pension benefits, the concentration is usually so extreme that the financial impact of a very small number of individuals is understated by a lives-based model, whether a GLM or a survival model. And that's simply because they're such a small proportion of the overall headcount, but such a large proportion of the liabilities. For most product lines, the weighting is perhaps unnecessary. For something like pensions portfolios, where there's such an extreme concentration, often find it useful to actually do this additional weighting step over and above using a benefit size or a pension size in the model. I agree with Andrew Smith. Heterogeneity is indeed not the only thing which may lie behind what I've actually been showing with this beard parameter. I'm not claiming it's the only thing. I'm saying that it is one possible explanation for this, and with the succession of models, I showed how this beard parameter, which I said could be used as an indicator of unexplained variation, did in fact shrink from model to model as we improved the fit and we improved the the parameter fit. But I do accept the point, it is not the only interpretation for that particular parameter. Last of all, Andrew asked about why there aren't any fitted parameters. There are some, but I wanted to avoid the paper being a wall of numbers. I'm more than happy to provide parameters for some of the final fitted models as a written contribution so that in the journal that they'll be there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Right. Has any of that provoked any other thoughts? Peter Tompkins, well done.
Peter Tompkins. I just was minded to make a small contribution, listening to the discussion from Mr. Edwards and the response from Mr. Richards on the use of postcode rating and the way in which this paper very helpfully explains to us the geodemographic work that they have done. And that's to perhaps just put the observation that I think we're seeing this being used in many of the pricing activities going on for those who are buying and selling annuity products in the interface between the life offices providing the solution for some of the pension schemes that want to lose annuities. And I think perhaps the predictive nature of the work that you and others are doing is in part leading to an assessment of what those that are doing the pricing, the other side of the table, are trying to do when they're coming up with quotations for the cost of taking their annuities onto their books. And perhaps there is a danger in a herd instinct developing around a field of a particular area of postcode analysis, and it was interesting to see the comments that you put in the paper about a range of possible choices of databases. And I would just strike a caution around those. There are however many thousands of postcodes and subgroupings and so on and so forth, but there is of course a lot of change that goes on. If you're adding, shall we say, 10% to the housing stock of the UK in the next 15 years, or whatever the number is at the moment that the government is dreaming up, as well as migration of quality and location of housing around the country, it's probably quite important that both through your analysis and the work that goes on with the various agencies that do the analysis of the subgroupings that they produce, that this is kept in check in order that if models can be refined and made better, better pricing and more accurate assessments of whether it's worth taking the risk off the particular pension scheme, shall we say, that wants to offload it onto the insurer that has a price, in order to help people who are assessing that determine whether or not that price be good.
Martin Lowes.
Just a question for Stephen, if I may. With 60-odd geodemographic categories to start with, I would welcome a few comments on why you chose to divide that into three groups for the purpose of an analysis, rather than, say, four or five groups.
Gordon Sharp, just one very particular point, and I think if I picked up Stephen correctly, he talked about needing a model to have an ever-increasing force of mortality with age. Of course, those of us who were at the SAMHSA presentation the other week saw what the SAMHSA committee have graduated and have chosen an arbitrary fixed rate of mortality at the very old ages, and because of the very sparse amount of data. But looking at what data there is at the very old ages, I think will become ever more important. The SAPS data did pick up on what we can find on the ONS data, and I wonder if we perhaps try to make our models too theoretical, and the word empirical that was used earlier I do have quite a lot of sympathy with.
Who would like to go next? Oh, yes. Hand towards the back, yes. You, sir. Who is it? Chris O'Brien.
Three points. First, I can well understand the benefit that life insurers have in using postcode as an indicator of mortality. I wasn't quite sure why the same needed to apply to occupational pension schemes, who presumably have decent occupation information. So isn't that adequate for occupational pension schemes? Second was, Stephen mentioned the increasing differentials by socioeconomic class in terms of expectation of life. The ONS data from last autumn suggested that that might actually be diminishing, so it may be that there's some lessening of that trend. And thirdly, we've talked about the way in which postcode is a proxy for the underlying drivers of mortality, and I think the profession will benefit from understanding the results of medical studies where you have longitudinal surveys of individuals and their mortality. And we've seen data that's given some indication of the link between lifestyle factors and mortality, in particular tobacco consumption, alcohol consumption, amount of exercise, and also diet. And I think that if we understand those drivers, those links between behaviour and mortality, then I think firstly that will put us in a better position to predict future changes in mortality, because we can start thinking about what might be the changes in exercise, diet, and so on in the future, and we can hopefully understand the impact that that would have on mortality. And secondly, it raises the issue as to how we actually underwrite, certainly as regards annuities. It may be quite useful to underwrite annuities by asking someone for their postcode, which seems fairly new, kind of a neutral kind of question. May be rather impertinent to start asking questions about how much time they spent at the gym last week and so on, but that might give a better information about mortality.
Thank you, Chris. Right, yes.
Hi, Brian Wilson. And I've got two totally separate comments I'd like to make. Firstly, on behalf of the CMI SAPS committee, we are now collecting postcode data, please. So all scheme actors present, can you do your very best to send in data with postcodes so that we can start analysing data on that basis? Totally separately, reduction in smoking as a driver for mortality improvement is something which is very obviously in need of greater analysis. Richard Humble and I are putting a paper to the SIAS meeting on the 22nd of April on that very subject, and invite all here to come along.
Very good. Thank you very much, Brian. Do we have any more contributions?
I'd like to pick up on the comment made by Mike Klipling that we would like to see 21st century solutions to mortality. The recent graduations done by the CMI have been produced by taking the, dividing the portfolio and graduating parts of it. I think I would like to see the profession moving forward to the CMI to use survival models or GLMs to try and get more information from the large amounts of data we've got. I'm afraid it is rather leaving the CMI to try and arbitrate between two warring factions.
Can you just give your name for the record?
Sorry, Bob Holston.
Any more? Yes, Matthew, you want another go? You can have another go, yeah?
So I wasn't intending to develop some sort of tennis match argument, especially as I'm not very good at tennis. Although if we had some more time, it'd be interesting to go into this prophecy, this sort of self-prophesying model concept, which I'm wondering if we have got into this sort of trap. Clarifying one of the earlier points about postcode, I suppose I use the word region in the abstract sense, which you often do, region meaning postcode or postcode, sector or district, whatever the data suggests. Clearly, in the question of postcodes versus proxies, if you actually want to look at mortality, then you should be looking at mortality at the postcode level, deriving the sort of residual mortality effect at the postcode level, and then working from there, which seems to me intuitively obvious that almost by definition, that will give you mortality-based postcode clusters, which will be intuitively be more predictive than any proxy. And of course, whether or not they are is something we'll empirically check, given that we work in this empirical field. So perhaps that was my fault earlier for being sort of insufficiently clear as to the sort of abstract use of the word region, not meaning a large geographical grouping. It's quite interesting, this concept of self-prophesying models is of particular interest to me, having a bit of a GI background as well as a life background. I'm quite interested in some sort of, if it would be permitted, some sort of show of hands as to the extent to which this self-prophesying model problem is well known about on the life side, because I guess most people here are from a purely life background. So if I were to say, is the concept of a self-prophesying model with particular regard to the geographical factor a known thing, would anyone actually put their hand up?
Could you describe it first?
Well, that takes the fun away. So, okay. So I made various allusions to it in my paper, thinking there's a good chance that lots of people would be familiar with it, because in fact, if this room is full of GI people, then I think everybody would be familiar with the problem that it's very easy to overfit a model to the postcode factor in particular, so that you end up with a model which actually loses hugely in its predictiveness because you've not gone through the right hoops. So if you've got a few minutes spare, I'd be quite happy to go into that as an interesting concept, and it seems to me an issue which may be at stake here.
5 minutes.
Well, it'll be probably half of that.
Aye.
Well, depending on the pauses for drinks. The problem then of self-prophesying models is a classic trap, which is very easy for analysts without a full wide range of experience to fall into, especially if the resulting models are not properly checked for predictiveness against an independent part of the data. And this is why it's so crucial to actually spend a lot of the time in the modelling with sort of independent predictiveness checks, because it's an empirical field. What counts is what's predictive. That's the test. Describing the problem in general terms, it consists of deriving models which are fine-tuned to replicate the observed experience in a way which systematically magnifies distortions arising from random fluctuations, consequently making the model much less predictive of future events than it should be, or than it could be, or it should be. And we can illustrate it by way of example. Suppose we have an observed experience of around 10,000 deaths and a geographical or geodemographic classification involving around 10,000 sectors of some sort, sector here being in a sort of completely abstract sense. Assuming, again, to keep things simple, that we have a fairly even exposure distribution. And we would see on average of the order of around one death in each sector. But whether, in fact, we have zero or one or maybe two or more deaths in any sector is highly susceptible to random fluctuation. And people have a tendency to live or die in an integer sort of way without paying due respect to all of the mortality formulae in the established literature. Now, if we use these results to order the thousands of sectors in some way and combine them into a smaller number of groups, our groupings will obviously be influenced by this randomness. At this stage, we do not necessarily have a problem. However, if we now use the same data to quantify the mortality effect associated with each of these groups, the effect of the random fluctuations feeds in again, but now in a systematic and highly distorting fashion, to give us a model which will be fine-tuned to replicate the observed experience, but at the cost of being much worse at predicting future events. In the paper, there's an automated grouping procedure described on page 15, which initially comes across as very clever. But I think the risk here is if you apply a very clever automating procedure, then that procedure is actually likely to exacerbate the effect in question about as much as it's possible to do. Giving us a model which will be especially clever, therefore, at trying to replicate historical random fluctuations and especially unclever at predicting future mortality. The problem will, in fact, get worse if we are starting with a very granular decomposition of the portfolio, or if we're dealing with a modeled event with a low claim frequency, e.g. mortality, as opposed to motor third party. So in the present instance, we have, I suppose, both of those conditions together, so the potential problem is about as bad as it can get. It's a very well-known trap to be aware of in this field, and there are some fairly standard ways to treat the data to avoid falling into this trap. And in fact, most professional multivariate software packages provide the necessary tools in this regard to take users through the hoops and avoid falling into this self-prophesying model fallacy. But it's interesting to consider what the financial effects of that sort of error might be. Basically, therefore, we're getting the geodemographic factors very wrong because we've produced a model which replicates random fluctuations, thereby at the cost of being much less predictive. If we're deriving substantially wrong geodemographic factors, but applying those relativities to a portfolio basis with a well-estimated overall level of mortality experience, then we might expect the overall basis to be materially incorrect, but not disastrously so. In effect, we're moving cards around the deck and getting the order of the cards wrong in some way, but we're not miscounting the total number of cards. So that's a fairly rubbish analogy, but it's the most I could think of. If, however, we take substantially wrong geodemographic factors and apply them in isolation to estimate the mortality experience of some other book of business, where we don't reliably know the overall level of mortality, which is something which people apparently do, then the errors discussed will feed directly through to give a potentially very wrong mortality basis. And it's likely to be substantially wrong, or even more substantially wrong, whether the geodemographic profile of the book in question differs materially from that of the data set used to derive the factors. And obviously, if that mortality basis were then to be used in pricing some bulk annuity bid, the results could be embarrassing, to say the least, with mispricing by many millions of pounds. So that was my initial concern about this self-prophesying model problem with any work to do with geodemographic factors, where we're not taking the necessary safeguards to do the appropriate things with the data. So I don't know if that's an interesting topic for discussion or not. It seems quite interesting.
Thank you very much, Matthew. We possibly have time for one more contribution. No? Everyone done? In which case, I will ask Nigel Bodie to close the discussion.
Right. I stand in front of this audience tonight as a humble economist. The discussion between Stephen Richards and Matthew Edwards in particular shows that they play this game in the Premier Division. I am struggling to avoid relegation to the non-league football. One of the principles that I did understand when I studied economics was that there might be different ways of reaching a similar answer, and could you in fact derive an answer to a question in two different and independent ways. And I think we really should not seek to throw away either of the methodologies that have been espoused so powerfully this evening, because we really need to know the answers to this question. As Matthew pointed out, there really is no point in starting from the wrong place, as well as needing to know about what future improvements are going to do. And I would suggest that our ability to project future improvements, our understanding of the linkage between diseases, is such that we really are groping very much in the dark when the regulator has talked about making evidence-based decisions. We have a fighting chance of getting that right in terms of current mortality. In the absence of a proven form of time travel, we have no evidence about future improvements, and so we have to develop our own theories on that, and we are going to have to debate them, but we must get the starting point right. There was debate over the question of whether smoothness is desirable. I sit with Brian Wilson on the SAPS committee, and we certainly found that, particularly when looking at all pensioner data, smoothness does not exist. Once you drop below age 50, you go from a grouping of people, some of whom are ill health pensioners and some of whom are normal health pensioners, and at 49, you have nothing but ill health pensioners. So I do not find myself persuaded by a desire for smoothness, because quite clearly the way pension schemes operate can at certain points militate very much against smoothness. The point was also raised, can occupational schemes not provide their own data with regard to regional fluctuations in mortality? Well, there is a significant problem with this. The largest schemes will tend quite often not to be focused in particular areas. There are some. There will be some schemes will be focused in particular, say, areas of manufacturing, but they will also have sales forces that are spread over a wide range of the country. Other large schemes will have their workforce spread all over the country, and we then have the same problem trying to identify regional variation. How are we going to do it? We're going to end up probably using postcodes again. But the smaller schemes are the ones that have the real problem. They are local, but they do not have sufficient data to be able to do their own projections. So we do have to come up with some model that will enable us to use more broadly based indicators of what mortality rates are before we then go into modelling the future. Now, we've got a slightly unusual situation here that the presenter of the paper has already had one go at answering questions. I think I will draw my efforts at concluding the discussion there and offer Stephen the chance to come back one more time.
Thank you very much, Nigel. I'll back you to avoid relegation. And Stephen, it's your chance to respond.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'd like to assure people this is the last time I'll be speaking tonight. I have a plane to catch, so it really will be the last you'll hear of me. To bring up a point raised by Bob Hoskins about the CMI using survival models, CMI actually does already use survival models. It uses it for PHI, but it also uses it in graduation and mortality tables. The software the CMI uses, it fits models for the force of mortality from UX, and that is, in fact, a form of survival model, albeit for group data rather than individual data. The CMI has been using survival models probably for 25, 30-odd years. Martin Lowe's point about why three groups, one reason is simplicity. The data set here would indeed support more lifestyle groups on a statistical basis. One reason for not using more is that although they're statistically different or significantly different statistically, there's actually some very small numbers of very high mortality individuals of not particularly great financial significance. So while I could have fitted five or even seven mortality groups to this particular data set, some of them would have been a very small groups and are not really of any financial significance. So I chose to keep it simple. The question about using postcode as a proxy, obviously something like smoker status or gym membership usage would in fact be very useful indeed. The only reason why we're using postcode is, I suppose it's twofold. One is it's largely available, so whereas smoker status for pensioners is usually not. The other reason for using it for pricing is not only is it actually very useful in predicting mortality differentials, but it's also a very unobtrusive piece of data that a life insurance company will already collect, for example, whereas collecting things like smoker status would be a more obtrusive process, and it would actually require asking for new information. One of the advantages of postcode and things like pension size is it's information you already have. You don't need to do anything new to change your underwriting models. Finally, to reply to Matthew Edwards' point, now that he's defined self-prophesying models, I can assure him that this does not apply to these survival models. In particular, the small groups issue that you raise most definitely does not apply to the way these models were actually fitted. The groups, the lifestyle groups that were actually used here, were actually fitted to groups with thousands, if not tens of thousands, of deaths and hundreds of thousands of lives as exposure. They're actually, the aggregation takes place through mapping postcode to mosaic type, mapping mosaic type to one of three lifestyle groups, and then fitting the model. What Matthew Edwards outlined of fitting a model on very small numbers of, very large numbers of postcode regions with very small numbers of lives, and then aggregating that would indeed lead to exactly the problems that he outlined. But because we're actually not doing this, those problems do not actually apply. So this model would not be a self-prophesying model and would not suffer from the flaws that Matthew Edwards pointed out. It does not fit a model highly parameterized and then aggregate. It actually does the aggregation stage and then actually fits to a much larger number of deaths in each particular group. So this small groups issue most definitely does not apply to the survival models. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. Well, we've, after a rather unpromising start with only one hand going up, we've had a good discussion, some controversy, which I hope will continue in the journal and the pages of the Actuary. And it now remains for me to express my thanks, and I'm sure the thanks of all of us, to the author, the opener, the closer, and all of those who participated in this evening's discussion. Can we please thank them in the usual way? It would be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if you could hand any prepared notes. I'm not sure very many people have prepared notes. To Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons at the back of the hall as you leave the meeting. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday the 31st of March 2008, when a paper, Variable Annuities, will be presented. Now we have the result of the election vote. All the votes are in and have been duly counted and verified, and the total number of votes cast was 1,270. The number of votes in favour was 885, which is about 70% of those cast. That unfortunately falls short of the required 75% majority. So Andrew Smith has not been elected as a Fellow of the Institute of Actuaries. I have to say I'm extremely disappointed by that outcome. I think Andrew has amply demonstrated that he has the breadth and depth of understanding of the syllabus to be considered equivalent to any other fellow. But the rules are the rules, and I guess Andrew can console himself with the fact that he has had the support of 70% of those who voted, and a very strong support also from Institute Council.